Without Senate action, this country will be hit with a wrecking ball. An apt description.
A debate in Congress makes for a tough road ahead for labeling GMO salmon. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, March 16th. Good evening. I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, is the permanent fund more like a college fund or a retirement account?
Our child just graduated from high school, and it's time to start thinking about how we're going to use our sovereign wealth most effectively.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Join the Salmon Project this month as they highlight the salmon lives of Alaskans and communities across the state. Find them on Facebook or visit salmonlife.org to make sure you don't miss these powerful stories. This message sponsored by the Salmon Project.
Support for APRN Iditarod coverage comes from Wells Fargo, proud supporter of the Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the trail. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
President Barack Obama today nominated Merrick Garland to the U.S. Supreme Court. Both of Alaska's U.S. senators issued written statements reaffirming their support for the Senate's Republican leaders who are refusing to hold a hearing or a vote on the nominee. Senator Dan Sullivan says blocking the nominee's advance is about principle, not the individual. Sullivan says Alaskans deserve to have a say in who is selected through their vote for president in November. Senator Murkowski says with a divisive election season underway, any nominee is likely to become a political football. Democrats counter that. Until the next executive is sworn in, President Obama is the person voters chose to fill Supreme Court vacancies. Since the FDA approved Aqua Advantage, a genetically altered salmon, as safe to eat last fall, Senator Lisa Murkowski has worked on a labeling mandate that would inform consumers the fish is genetically engineered. This morning, the U.S. Senate considered a bill that would make that impossible. The bill didn't get enough votes to advance, but the debate shows the forces Murkowski is up against when it comes to labeling genetically modified organisms. APRN's Liz Ruskin reports.
Food manufacturers and agribusiness fiercely oppose labeling laws for genetically modified food. They say the label would suggest the food is unsafe. But Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell doesn't mention the industry in describing the purpose of the bill. McConnell says it's
aimed at protecting middle-class families from unfair higher food prices.
The bill would nullify state laws requiring GMO labeling, like the fish labeling law the Alaska legislature passed a decade ago. More urgently for the bill's proponents, it would block a Vermont law that would require labeling of all GMO foods starting in July. Republican Senator Pat Roberts of Kansas told his colleagues if they don't pass his bill, the states will enact a patchwork of laws requiring GMO foods to carry what he describes as demonizing labels.
Without Senate action, this country will be hit with a wrecking ball, an apt description, that will disrupt the entire food chain.
Roberts warns that failure to pass his bill will cost each family more than $1,000 a year in higher prices, and he says the hardship will be widespread.
From the farmer who will be pressured to plant fence row of a crop that is less efficient, to the grain elevator that will have to adjust storage options to separate types of grain, to the manufacturer who will need different labels for different states, to the distributor who will need expanded storage for sorting, and to the retailer, who may be unable to afford offering low-cost private label products.
The bill would allow voluntary labeling and possibly later require manufacturers to include phone numbers or barcodes the consumer can scan with a smartphone. Senator Barbara Boxer, a Democrat from California, called it an anti-labeling bill and a sham. She imagined a busy dad in a supermarket holding his phone up to a QR code, scrolling through information on a company website.
Or he's going to have to call a 1-800 number. Can you believe this? The man is going through the grocery store. He's got 50 products in his cart. He's going, wait a minute, kids, just a minute.
Senator Lisa Murkowski tried to draw a distinction between mandatory labeling of genetically modified crops, which has substantial opposition in Congress, and labeling of GMO fish. Murkowski says she's against the anti-labeling bill because of what it would mean for salmon.
It's not opposition to the overall bill or its underpinnings. Where my concern remains is mistakenly allowing genetically engineered salmon into our homes mislabeled as salmon.
The bill got only 48 of the 60 votes it needed to advance, but its advocates say they're not giving up. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
More than 1,000 people from 30 different countries are in Fairbanks for Arctic Science Summit Week. One of the highlights includes a meeting of the Arctic Council, a multinational governmental forum created to address the Arctic's pressing issues. KTOO's Matt Miller reports.
The Arctic Council is an intergovernmental body that includes representatives from 8 Arctic member nations and 6 permanent participant delegations from various indigenous groups. The permanent participants can provide input and advise the Council on policy issues, but they do not have a vote. The Arctic Council's recommendations are non-binding on participating governments. There are also nearly 24 observers from other European and Asian countries and intergovernmental and non-governmental organizations who are also allowed to sit in on council meetings.
I would argue that with the Arctic Council, there's a lot more dialogue going on with the nations that are engaged in Arctic dialogue than perhaps anywhere else.
That's UAF Vice Chancellor Mike Sfraga, who is leading the creation of a new Center for Arctic Policy Studies. Sfraga says the Arctic Council's work does not seem to be colored by other worldwide conflicts and disputes like Crimea and Syria.
There are personal relationships, there are nation relationships that still have yet to be damaged by other international issues going on. The tensions are there. But in the North, there seems to be just a very different dynamic. And it is driven by, of course, resource development, but it's also driven by the fact that we have people reliant on the land. It's a place where we have traditionally cooperated before. And there just seems to be a willingness in the Arctic Council, a consensus-building body, that we will leave the Arctic alone as much as you can from other international dynamics.
The Arctic Council started a 3-day meeting behind closed doors Tuesday on the University of Alaska Fairbanks campus. Also on Tuesday, the Model Arctic Council wrapped up a 7-day meeting on campus. Over 60 students from 13 countries crafted position papers and drafted policy recommendations on cruise ship tourism, managing maritime traffic in the Arctic, improving access to running water and sewer, and reducing suicide among various indigenous groups. Model Arctic Council members were surprised when they learned that their final paper, called the Fairbanks Declaration, will become the starting point for discussions among Arctic Council members next year. This week's Arctic Science Summit Week also includes hundreds of scientists from around the world who are coordinating research that is focusing on the effects of climate change on a rapidly changing Arctic. Reporting in Fairbanks, I'm Matt Miller.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Houston in the Matsu Valley is poised to become a marijuana oasis in the middle of a sea of pot bans.
We voted on it not once, but twice. And the second time it was also the residents wanted marijuana. So, done deal.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on Condor.com. Condor, born to fly.
Get away and stay in Alaska at UAS Juneau. Small enough that your professors know you by name. Big enough for a vibrant campus community with a new freshman residence hall. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Southeast.
As the state legislature begins the final month of the session, one big question is looming. How are lawmakers going to pay for the budget? Even with several hundred million dollars in cuts, the state has a more than $3 billion deficit to fill. Members of the Republican-led Senate majority differ with Governor Bill Walker on whether the state should permanently address its budget problems and whether the state needs new taxes. APRN's Andrew Kitchenman reports.
Much of the debate is focused on how far permanent fund earnings should be restructured to pay for government on an ongoing basis, like Walker has proposed, or whether to just draw from the earnings reserve like the state has tapped the constitutional budget reserve in previous years. Soldotna Republican Senator Peter Michicki says the government only has to close part of the budget gap this year. In part, that's because it can expect higher returns from oil prices in the future. He sees similarities between Alaska's situation, having saved money in permanent fund earnings, and that of a family saving for college.
And our child just graduated from high school, and we're saying, well, actually, we're not going to use that money that we've saved for the last 18 years for you. We're going to find some other way to pay for your college, but we're not sure what it is right now. When you look at where we are financially, our child just graduated from high school, and it's time to start thinking about how we're going to use our sovereign wealth most effectively.
Governor Walker wants a long-term solution, so the revenue the state brings in this year will be stable in the future. State Attorney General Craig Richards worked on the centerpiece of Walker's plan to change permanent fund earnings into a stable source of revenue. He says the state situation is more like a family facing retirement without its longtime source of revenue than a family paying for 4 years of college.
You know, Alaska for 30 years lived off very generous petroleum revenues. Due to prices and production declines, we no longer can. So we've built up a huge savings account to essentially live off of in the later years, and we're at those later years. So to me, that's why it's all about you need to draw from your retirement assets in a sustainable manner, because we need to live off that money for a very long time.
Walker also supports introducing an income tax and increasing other taxes to build a sustainable budget. But Republican leaders are skeptical of the need for more taxes. They do want to draw from the permanent fund earnings reserve and other savings accounts, but with less extensive changes than those proposed by Walker. And Senate Budget Committee co-chairman Pete Kelly, a Fairbanks Republican, also wants to cut spending more. He says nothing happened to government services after the state sustained nearly $400 million in cuts in the current budget year.
That tells me it was that fat. It was at least fat by $400 million in the day-to-day operations. We're going to do it again. And you know what? It's possible. I don't think it's likely, but it's possible that will go too far. In which case, guess what? We can come back here next year and fix it.
Anchorage Democratic Senator Berta Gardner says she's concerned that more cuts could destroy programs that would take time to rebuild. And she questioned Kelly's statement that nothing happened after this year's cuts.
I would propose that if he thinks that, he should talk to fishermen, he should talk with seniors, our lowest income seniors, he should talk with students and with teachers who all are experiencing great changes in their world because of the cuts that we've made.
Gardner says an advantage of Walker's approach is that it would affect all state residents and non-residents who make money in the state in the case of the income tax. She notes that the state is facing credit downgrades if it doesn't address the budget shortfall, which will raise the cost for the state to borrow money. Walker says he's willing to work with legislators, but he wants that work to lead to a sustainable budget.
Alaska deserves a conclusion this year. They deserve a product that's finished this year. So we can do it. All the tools are there. All the motivation is there. If we don't, we know what the price is if we don't. The price for kicking the can down the road is way too expensive for Alaska.
Legislators expect to resolve how to pay for the budget toward the end of the legislative session. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
The Pioneer Home System is older than the state. The first in Sitka was repurposed from abandoned Marine barracks in 1913. The state-funded system now operates six locations and provides care to 440 seniors. Demand is growing. As lawmakers grapple with the budget, some wonder whether the state can keep funding the homes at all. KCAW's Emily Kwong reports.
If you're walking around downtown Sitka, you can't miss the Pioneer Home. It sits on a hill, crowned in crocuses and rose hips. And gazing out towards Sitka Sound, with a walking stick in one hand and a pickaxe in the other, is an enormous sculpture of a gold prospector. Around town, he's known as the Pioneer.
Almost all of the men who have come to the Alaska Pioneers Home are of the highest type of American trailblazer.
Those are the words of Arthur G. Shoup, the first superintendent of the Sitka Pioneer Home, read by Philip Welsh, the current administrator. The home was built to care for Alaska's early homesteaders, miners, bush pilots, fishermen, and now there are six homes spread throughout the state, and they care for Alaska's elderly, those over 65 who have gotten off the wait list and earned a coveted spot. As Welsh makes the rounds, he stops here and there to fix someone's collar.
If you end up with somebody and you see them with their shirt undone because they can't see, button up their shirt. Allow them to be as independent as possible for as long as possible. That will help maintain their dignity.
While few in the state would contest the importance of the Pioneer Homes, lawmakers are beginning to wonder whether it's still possible for the state to keep funding operations. For the next fiscal year, both the governor and the legislature want to cut at least $1 million in state support for the Pioneer Homes, which is now at $37 million. And to explore privatizing some or all of the home's services. The Walker administration is on board. Here's Budget Director Pat Pitney.
We have to reduce. Can somebody do the same service at the same quality for less money? You know, most other places don't have the state running the care homes.
Only Wyoming and Arizona have anything similar to Alaska's Pioneer Homes. The state issued a request for letters of interest for private operators in mid-January, and four companies responded. Here's Jessica Boggard, administrative operations manager with the homes.
For the request for letters of interest, the responses were really a no-cost way of testing the waters in terms of privatization.
Among the responders was Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium, which offered to buy the whole system. Marathon Development Incorporated from Washington and Retirement Housing Foundation in California were interested in managing operations. And Juneau-based Nana Management Services, which already provides food for all the homes, offered to tack on housekeeping and maintenance if a partner came along to manage the direct care. The Department of Health and Social Services is now conducting a feasibility study to explore the idea. And on the revenue side, a legislative subcommittee recently proposed charging seniors $100 a year to keep their spot on the wait lists. 5,325 Alaskans are waiting to join the Pioneer Homes. This worries Boggard.
We serve kind of a low-income, high-risk population, and so $100 a year to maintain a waiting list status, yeah.
These are people who don't really have money. We're just depleting what's left of their savings.
That's Anchorage Representative Les Guerra, who says that turning over the keys to a private operator would cripple the quality of care.
Privatization in the long run always costs more because you have to pay for profit. And then when you're paying for profit, then the profit motive leads to lower levels of services to increase the profit. That's what's happened with private prisons. They were a failure.
Residents are already feeling the growing costs of the Pioneer Homes in their own pocketbooks. Rates jumped last year by 8.5% to keep up with a federal formula. So a privately paying resident with Alzheimer's now shells out $162,000 a year to live in the Pioneer Homes. This is a far cry, though, from private nursing homes in Alaska, where the median cost is $270,000 a year. Back at the Sitka Pioneer Home, Welsh says his residents are well aware of the privatization conversation brewing at the Capitol.
Residents, they're going nuts. They're so angry.
For now, Welsh focuses on the work.
I've gone into rooms, you know, many, many times and seen a CNA sitting there with someone who's on their last day singing them a song or reading them a book or holding their hand, just not leaving them alone. Our mission statement is that we provide elder Alaskans a home and community celebrating life through its final breath.
And that means ensuring all residents, no matter their status or the fate of the homes entirely, will receive care until the very end. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Emily Kwong.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Alaska Pacific University delivers a distinctive educational adventure designed to support your personal and professional goals. Through generous APU scholarship packages and the new APU Promise Tuition Grant Program, APU is a sound educational investment in your future. Apply today at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
Bring the wisdom and the Alaska culture into the classroom while participating in crafts, telling stories, or teaching a language. Elders age 55 or older, apply at ruralcap.com. This message sponsored by Rural Alaska Community Action Program, Inc.
Ken Kelsch will be Juneau's new mayor. Unofficial results from Tuesday's special election show Kelsch with 59% of the vote. Kelsch read a prepared statement before addressing his supporters.
I feel positive about our future. My goal is to unite us as a community. I will work hard for you with honor and with integrity. We have our work cut out for us, so let's unite.
Kelsch is expected to be sworn in on April 4th after results are certified. Karen Crane, who received 40% of the vote, was on the Juneau Assembly until she resigned to run for mayor. In Juneau's form of government, the mayor is a largely ceremonial position. In assembly business, the mayor's vote carries the same weight as the other eight members. Two cities in the Matanuska-Susitna borough have opted to ban marijuana sales and grow operations, but Houston is aiming to bolster its city revenues with legal marijuana commerce. Alaska Public Media's Ellen Lockyer spoke with Houston Mayor Virgie Thompson on how that could shape the city's future.
Houston is a 22-square-mile entity in the middle of the Matanuska-Susitna borough. The borough communities of Palmer and Wasilla have banned pot sales, but Houston is bucking that trend. Mayor Virgie Thompson says the city survives on property taxes, sales taxes, and state revenue sharing. With Alaska's state finances heading downward because of the drop in oil prices, state help is dwindling. Thompson says last year, the city couldn't meet its budget.
And we ended up actually having to furlough employees at the end of last fiscal year because we didn't have the funds. We continued to pay their insurance, but we did have to furlough them from their daily responsibilities.
Houston also had to shutter its police department to pay for other city services. Thompson says the Houston City Council views marijuana retail as an opportunity. She says city voters turned down a city initiative banning commercial pot during the last city election.
We voted on it not once, but twice. And the second time it was also the residents wanted marijuana. So done deal. You know, now we're going to have to deal with it. This is what the people want.
A city ordinance introduced in February aims to regulate commercial pot grow operations and retail sales of cannabis products. If it passes, Houston will be an island of legal pot in a borough the size of West Virginia. This is not the first time Houston has taken its own path. Houston allows the sale of fireworks, which are prohibited throughout the Matsu borough and Anchorage. Thompson says the sales taxes on Roman candles help pay for emergency services such as fire response, and the income from pot excise and sales taxes could cover expenses of a new city police force. A public hearing on the city pot ordinance earlier this month drew a large crowd. One of the sticking points in the legislation is the on-site consumption of marijuana products. The initial ordinance language prohibited on-site consumption, and Thompson supports that.
They buy their ounce and they put it in the trunk of their car and they're gone. What they do after that, I'm sorry, I don't know. But as far as on-site consumption and somebody sitting in a parking lot out by the retail place and smoking, that's not going to be allowed. It's just the way it is.
Thompson says the city's proposed land use ordinance would create zoning to designate areas for grow operations or cannabis products shops. A 2% city sales tax on products and an excise tax of 8 to 10% an ounce has been proposed at the cultivation stage. But at the council meeting, an amendment changing the ordinance to allow on-site smoking in commercial and parks highway zones was put forward, and debate over it has delayed a vote until after a second public hearing. The mayor says the city code ought to follow state marijuana regulations rather than breaking new ground.
If we do something different,
than what the state is allowing at this point in time, then it is our responsibility to police that. My opinion is that we need to take baby steps. I don't think we should take everything on at the same time.
Land-rich Houston has the potential to attract marijuana grow operations, which in turn could supply other cannabis operations, Thompson says. The city has a sales tax, but too few businesses to contribute much to city coffers. The Houston City Council will take public comment on the ordinance on March 24th. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Two Bristol Bay drifters are among 10 young Alaskans who toured the East Coast last week to talk fish. The trip was organized by the Alaska Marine Conservation Council as part of its effort to foster a network of young fishermen. KDLG's Molly Dishner has more.
The first stop was the Boston Seafood Show, where NACNAC's Millie Vukic says she was listening for ideas to bring back to the Bay.
I just started a company distributing our family salmon to the lower 48. So I was definitely like in that mind frame of like, how could I do this better? I'm really new to it. But I think I realized just how much I value really good quality and that relationship with the person that you're going to. People are very, very, very excited to know who is bringing them their food, who is bringing them their fish. And there's more than just what I'm eating at dinner, but there's a story behind this.
In the Boston area, the group also met with young fishermen from the East Coast. Vukic says she enjoyed spending time with others who are as interested in fisheries as she is.
Honestly, I think that's probably the best part, being with people from different parts of Alaska, younger people. NACNAC doesn't have a lot of young people. It's really cool being able to be around other fishermen who are just as passionate about like being a fisherman and learning about fishing policy and learning about what we can do to make it better.
The focus shifted to advocacy and policy when the group met with Alaska's congressional delegation at their next destination.
Learned quite a bit in Washington, D.C. as well about what it looks like to approach somebody who makes decisions, kind of presenting something uniform so that we can find a common goal, I guess, with each other. So that it's not like one person's here with one agenda, one person's here with another agenda. We ended up being pretty united on like, we want access for younger people into fishery.
All the fish talk aside, Port Hyden resident Michael Shangan says one experience in particular made for a very memorable first trip to the East Coast.
We actually got to go watch Lisa speak at on the Senate floor, and she took us through underground tunnels and the senator's subways that people aren't allowed. We had like 12 people crammed up in a little trolley, and she set us in her family booth, which I thought was pretty cool. How many people can say they ran with their senator underneath the Capitol buildings or basements and tunnels?
After D.C., the group headed south to New Orleans for a couple days at the Slowfish Conference, where they heard about fisheries around the world, and a few, including Shangan, had the opportunity to talk about Alaska. In Dillingham, I'm Molly Dishner.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Andrew Kitchenman and Jeremy Shea in Juneau, Matt Miller in Fairbanks, Emily Kwong in Sitka, Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, and Molly Dishner in Dillingham. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Eric Bork. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by the Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence, and by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. Join the Salmon Project this month as they highlight the salmon lives of Alaskans and communities across the state. Find them on Facebook or visit salmonlife.org to make sure you don't miss these powerful stories. This message sponsored by the Salmon Project.
It's as easy as 1, 2, 3. 1, file your 2016 PFD application today. 2, receive a confirmation of filing. And 3, sign electronically with your secure My Alaska account. Visit pfd.alaska.gov for more information. And remember, the deadline to apply is Thursday, March 31st. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.